Greetings, you magnificent, you miserable, accursed. I'm David Hurley. With me, your ever-loving political panel, the strategists who typically were or still are in the meeting after the meeting, who put the cuss in discuss, and who are all uncommonly attractive humans. If you don't believe me, go watch this episode on the YouTube machine, people. You'll be amazed. Scott Reed, Corey Tonight, and Jordan Leichnitz. All right, here's the rundown. It's March, so it's motion madness this week on the pod. Reminds me, Scott, I had a pretty mediocre bracket this weekend. Our cursed clipping comes from Andrew Phillips, writing in The Star about the NDP motion amended by the Liberals on the Israeli-Palestine question. Just foreign policy theater, or did it accomplish anything for either party? Then there's Polyev's failed non-confidence motion on the carbon tax. The Liberals survived it with the backing of the Bloc and the NDP. So what was the play here for the CPC? In Ontario, on the housing file, Doug Ford is coming down hard on fourplex towers, and he's in a scuffle with the Fed about a failure to meet affordable housing targets. We'll talk about that. And then, mercifully, Gordon Pinsent brings proceedings to a close with our Hey Yous. Jordan, Scott, Corey, it's quite a funeral this weekend.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
You guys saw more of it than I did, but you were there in person.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was there. I got to tell you that the granddaughter,
yeah,
was such a beautiful moment. I mean, her version of that Edith Piaf song combined with her own tears was pretty moving, and I didn't think that could be topped until they did the Irish eyes are smiling thing, and when Mulroney's voice came on, it broke me. I mean, that was a beautiful moment. It was something.
Not only was it beautiful, but it was perfect. And I'll just echo, like, what the moment with Tia Lapp, and that was, it was his granddaughter, was so moving. But to me, I ran into my buddy Art Milnes, who compiled and wrote Mulroney's memoirs with him. He was at the funeral. I think he said hi to you, David. And
he did, yeah.
Right afterwards, he came over to the box where we were doing our broadcast, and he was laughing and laughing, and he said, it's the most perfect fucking thing in history that Brian Mulroney's funeral would end with Brian Mulroney inserting Brian Mulroney singing. He was like, it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. And it was both moving and fitting. I love that funeral. I thought it was just
Art Milnes told me that at Pierre Trudeau's funeral, which went 2 hours, John Turner came up to Brian Mulroney afterwards and said, it's too fucking long. We're not going 2 hours. Either you or me, we're not going 2 hours. Mulroney went 2:15.
Yeah, which is,
that
which
checks
is,
out.
Which is very fitting.
Totally, yeah. Checks out.
Carré went heavy. As we say in broadcast world, he went heavy.
Well, all right, we have a new funerals. Funerals, yeah, and other celebrations, I feel I should mention that Dennis Matthews turned 40 on the weekend, and so that was a happy celebration that we were marking of one of the friends of the podcast.
Anybody who's just turned 40 can go fuck themselves, as far as
I'm turning 50 this year, so I agree.
No comment.
All right, we have a new segment of the show today. It's called Corrections. The air quotes public editor has informed me that there were several key errors in last week's pod. I'll go first. The all-you-can-eat KFC buffet is in Weyburn, Saskatchewan. Okay? Fill yourself with the dirty bird next time you're down in Weyburn. Second, the Alberta NDP leadership candidate's name is properly pronounced Rocky Pancholi. Have I got it?
You did it.
Jordan? Yeah, I did it. Okay. Third, and most important if I am to remain a friend of Jordan Owens, is to acknowledge that there are two Liberal governments at the subnational level in Canada, Newfoundland and Yukon. Okay?
Right.
Now, Scott and Jordan, who is the Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador?
It is not a right-wing columnist, I'll tell you that much. So my apologies to the fine people of Newfoundland, though I've never quite forgiven you for electing Ryan Cleary. But we can move beyond that, and sorry about that, Andrew Fury.
Wait, did I repeat that mistake? Did I say that
first? You said it first.
Did I? Oh my God, I'm really sorry, Andrew Fury.
Just like further proof, we're just in our own little bubble here.
I think I also a few pods ago, I quoted Sweet City Woman, and I think I said sweet, sweet, sweet city woman, when it's actually sweet, 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 sweet city woman. There's four, not three sweets. And so I offer my deepest apologies.
Absolutely. Anybody else got a correction they want to get on the record now? Okay, good enough. Let's start with housing. It picks up where we left off last week talking about the changing tone between Ford and the Trudeau government, for sure. Sean Fraser and Doug Ford picked a fight with each other last week, it looks like to me, over housing. Quietly, federal opposition to Highway 413 went away, but the housing fight went DEFCON 3. First, Fraser said that Ontario has no housing plan and will not get federal money unless they produce one. Then Ford announced that his government will not allow fourplexes as of right in residential neighborhoods and rails against the idea of it in suburban Ontario. Fraser fires back with some biting social media posts about Ford's position. Scott, I like what Fraser's doing. You said last week they should pick any position that has more than 22% support. They need a fight on this because the housing crisis will not be solved by the next election. So you can't put a check mark beside that. So the only way the Liberals aren't the villain of this story is if somebody else is. And so I see Fraser trying to create that dynamic. What do you think?
Yeah, I think two things about it. First of all, I think, and I know Corey will disagree with this, and he'll have ample time to tell me I'm wrong. I think that Ford made a mistake. I think that the way that he came out, and not just the what he said, but the way he said it, the dismissive tone on the fourplexes, I think that was problematic for him. I don't think that's a position he really wants to tether himself to, because if your fundamental position is, listen, we're just McMansions, everybody wants a McMansion and that's all that, I think you're misreading the focus groups, he's misreading his data, and he's misreading the public. And I think that there's I think that's a miss on his part. And I think there's a little bit of political space. So I don't want to exaggerate it, but I think there's a little bit of political space on that. And particularly when the broader swirl around him is paid insiders who are then middlemen for heavy duty developers. And it just feels a little bit, and they're about to relaunch a whole new housing policy play, kind of a do-over. And I think they have got to be careful about the balance they strike there. But the most important takeaway, and the second thing I would say is your point, David, which is I like the Fraser's picking fights. In a world where we watch this federal government struggle so desperately to punch through, well, if you don't have money for advertising dollars, or if you're advertising Canada's dental plan brought to you by Canada, to find out more, click this link and you'll be bored as much as you are looking at this fucking like egg white shell fucking image. It's just so bad, the advertising. Pointless. So if you don't have money for advertising and you're not punching through by having three ministers stand outside of the House of Commons and declare things, then fight. Conflict generates attention and eyeballs. And I think this is a good fight. I think this allows him to put pressure on Ford. I think the Ford's going to be forced to respond. I think they go back and forth. I don't think that either side is going to give a bunch, you know, I'm not saying he's going to necessarily waste the money, but I don't think that they're going to fundamentally alter their positions. And so I think that's all, it creates some sustaining ink. And if you want people to think that you are about something and you can't suddenly just snap your fingers and have 2 million new homes built, then to be seen to be fighting for and against somebody in service to those things, then is at least a way of associating yourself with it. So I think that's all interesting. One small footnote, I don't know if you guys are detecting this, but I'm detecting something interesting out of Ottawa. And first, we had the video from Sean Fraser a couple of weeks ago where he ran hard at Pierre Poilievre. And now you had this conflict on Friday, letter to Ford. But I hear a little back channel muttering and buzz from Liberals, from like Liberals in the government. I'm not talking about PMO, right? So I don't want to just imply that. So I'll take, but others, like a little bit of jealousy. Like I hear this bitching among staffers going, well, you know, I mean, he's not the only fucking guy in Ottawa who knows how to communicate. And everybody thinks, you know, like it's unbelievable They're so goddamn bad. The first time,
I think they should take him down a peg myself.
That's exactly the tone you're getting on. It's like, Jesus Christ, you guys. Someone is able Liberals to swim across a bowl of water. And you're like, whoa, that fucking show off. It's ridiculous.
2 feet from the well. One size fits all, proclaims the sales tag. But does it really? One size fit all? Let's interrogate that, hurly-burlyites. In fashion, it generally just means big, doesn't it? Sloppy big. Elastic waistband big. Not tailored to individual needs or conditions big. Our presenting sponsor, TELUS, says the very same problem can apply to telecom. Hold that thought while I backtrack a bit. Last week, I told you the CRTC is exploring options for mandating wholesale wireline fiber to the premises. How to do it in a way that best promotes competition and provides Canadians with choice and affordability for high-speed internet. At the hearings last month, TELUS reiterated the Commission's own previous decisions, which have said over and over, there is no single national market for internet service. Any one-size-fits-all approach to mandating access to fiber networks won't account for regional competition needs, the effect of current regulation on different regions in Canada, and the investment challenges in building the networks across different parts of the country. Conditions out west do not mirror conditions in the east. Mountains get in the way, vast tracts of uninhabited craggy terrain. The builds are just a hell of a lot more expensive. That's not all. When it comes to existing regional wholesale competition, reseller market share is increasing markedly in Alberta and British Columbia, while significantly decreasing in Ontario and Quebec. That stretches the elastic waistband metaphor even further, hurly-burlyites. It is simply not one size fits all for every part of Canada. TELUS believes any new mandate must be tailored to different regional conditions. I'll leave it there for now. Next week, more data and, blessedly, a new metaphor. All right, Corey, what do you think? Is this a straight suburban downtown fight and Ford is solidifying suburbia? Is that what this is about?
Foraplex is, you know, they're not universally popular everywhere, and some mayors want them and some mayors don't. The trend lines are more towards doing more of these, but I think it's more about where you do them when you actually get to the local politics of it. But I'm not a big believer in one size fits all across the board. Like, what the Ford government position is we will defer to municipalities on some of these things. And I think a lot of municipalities will choose to go that route because the federal government is tying its funds to those decisions. But it's not a universally popular thing. So, like, I think insofar as anyone cares about this issue, all the research I've seen says that Ford's on the right side of it. So,
and what about the housing? What about the housing plan fight? Not just the fourplexes, but what about the Calandra Fraser?
Well,
fight?
It's ridiculous to say that the Ford government doesn't have a housing plan. It had a housing plan in the last election campaign. It has a housing plan now. It's not a housing plan maybe that Fraser likes, but it's silly to say that there isn't one there. Ford scores well on housing and better than the federal government, I might add. So, normally the way you get more popular is fighting on things where there's a wedge where you have more credibility and higher numbers than the person you're fighting with. I don't know if the Ford government has baited Fraser and the federal government into fighting on housing, then that's a good day for the Ford government and a bad day for the Trudeau government.
A little smug. That's a little self-serving and smug, though. Like, to be honest, because part of part of the letter is also trying to challenge some of that. Why, just talking housing and then the big McMahon, you just won Publishers Weekly Clearinghouse sweepstakes checks. Like,
well,
what he's pointing out is it's a Potemkin village. They haven't been built, and they're not getting built. The units aren't there.
Jordan, jump in here.
Yeah, Corey's not wrong. There is a plan. It's just not a plan that the Ford government has any hope in hell of meeting, right? And so I think, I like this fight. I like this fight, I think, for the federal Liberals. It's one that for once sets them with some energy and a good spokesperson on an issue that people care about. I think that Ford this week did open a flank of vulnerability around the decision about fourplexes, because look, at the end of the day, If housing is one of the top concerns of people in Ontario, you've had 5 years, and your plan is actually going worse, not better. They're not on track for 1.5 million homes by 2031. And housing starts are actually down, right? So everything that people are experiencing says that what Ford is doing is not working. And then on top of that, I think that the context that Ford is in right now around housing. So, you know, a year and a half ago when we were having this discussion, the great solution to the housing crisis in Ontario was going to be opening up the green belt. Well, how'd that go for you? So when your banner symbolic moves that are tying you to progress on housing are not working, and in fact, in Ford's case, have actually now become real problems for him, I do think that you got to be really careful when you open another flank on that, as he did this week around the decision on fourplexes. And look, it's not to say that every province is necessarily reacting to these problems in the same way. Like, you just look over at BC, they have a housing crisis as well, but they've taken some of the recommendations in the task force report that Ontario has let sit on a shelf for a couple of years. They're implementing them. And guess what? It's working. They've got their starts up 11%. So I think that people in Ontario aren't dumb. They're aware that other places are solving this problem differently. And I think that for the premier to appear in any way to be feeding in to the NIMBYism that research is also showing that people are really done with, a lot of voters are really done with that, I think is a detriment for him. So I think this move this week was not smart on his part. I do think it actually leaves them a bit open to attacks from the NDP and from the Liberals provincially. They've created space for those parties to walk into and to tell a different story on housing. So I don't think it was a good week for Ford on that.
Jordan, can I stick with you for a second? Sorry, go ahead, Corey.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, look, you know, what is the biggest challenge on the housing front for everyone? It's interest rates. And I think people understand that that's actually what's the biggest factor that's slowing development growth across the board. You know, looking at just pure percentage of starts is really a misleading statistic. Ontario is such a huge market. To move the needle 1% there is just so many more houses that you're having to build than it is, you know, increasing the housing supply in Prince Edward Island or some other fucking place. So, look, I think there are challenges on housing for sure. Interest rates are the
number one.
We'll
be sure to drop a note of apology to all our PEI listeners.
Well, yeah, exactly. But
Vancouver's not in PEI, Corey.
Well, you know, but it's, you know, the size of the market does make a huge difference. Look, it's a question, you know, what is the change in policy there? It's very, you know, we're arguing about something very subtle that very few people understand. And if you think it's going to move the needle on voters, then I think you're misleading yourself. I think the big thing and the big fight that's going on right now, with not just between Ontario and the federal government, but every province virtually in the federal government, is the carbon tax. And I think insofar as there's any strategy in what Fraser's trying to do, it's trying to change the topic off the carbon tax, where they're getting their clock cleaned, and onto something else, anything else. And, you know, the anything else that they're taking, maybe fighting on housing is better for them because it's less unpopular. Their record is less bad than it is on carbon tax. But look, voters aren't supportive of the federal government on housing or on carbon tax. They're just, you know, the gap is a little bit less extreme on housing than it is on carbon tax.
Scott, I hear. To use your terminology from a number of pods ago, some tapping on the submarine pipes. And I'm, first of all, I think that there are two ministers that actually have been impressing me a lot recently. The other is Miller, who seems to have a plan that's thought through for getting his hands around this immigration issue. And this week announced restrictions on temporary foreign workers that appear to have been well received and well thought through. So there's that. But, you know, when I think of how the Trudeau government for many years bent over backwards to get along with Ford and to be seen to have good relations with Ford. When I watch what's happening now between Trudeau's comments about carbon tax, which I don't think are really strategic, but fit this theory, and then what Fraser's doing, etc., do you think they have decided that since Poiliev is giving them nothing to run against, that they're going to run against the conservative premiers in the country?
Maybe. I'm not certain that they've made that call. I think it's more a case of let's wildly throw punches and see if we hit a jaw. I do think, you know, to be fair and to underline your point, I think that Miller's been thoughtful, and I think Fraser's been methodical and consistent, which is important. I mean, one of the things that you never get out of this government is persistence and consistency. Let's do something for a number of months in a row and try to build up some groove in the highway. But I don't know that it's as unified field theory as you've just elaborated. I don't know that they've made a focused decision to go after and contrast themselves with the provinces. And one of the reasons I don't think that's a deliberate decision is if you were going to do that, you would hear it from the prime minister. It would be on a more profound level about competing visions of Canada. You don't hear that kind of rhetoric out of these guys. And so I'm not convinced that's where, maybe it will evolve to that. Maybe they'll look at this and say, hey, some apples seem to be dropping from this tree. Let's try to take possession of the whole orchard. But I'm not sure that that's a strategy yet.
I agree with Scott. There's no evidence to suggest that this is something flowing outwards from the PMO to the minister's office. This is, I think, you've got Fraser, who clearly has found a couple scraps that he and his team are interested in, and they're going after them. And I think credit to them is probably the most effective communication on this topic that that the Liberals have had in years. But I think, you know, for Liberals, this should be worrying, right? You still have really no evidence of central direction around an attack against Conservatives, be they provincial or federal. There's no evidence of a cogent strategy there. And while I think Fraser is doing well, you know, as we've discussed, like, it's not all hits, right? You need to power this stuff up with some research. You need to have a cohesive message. You need to get all of your cabinet singing from the same songbook. And I think to speak to what Scott was just talking about, you got to stick to it. And this is something that I think in particular, the Liberal government has really, really struggled to do. Anytime that they do have a bit of a toehold, they haven't been able to stick with it long enough to actually impress any negatives upon their opponents.
Can I add one quick thing before we go to Corey? Just if they were going to be implementing that strategy, it would have been implemented in an undeniable, unmistakable, oh my God, I saw it fashion the week prior. When the prime minister basically skipped across the country and did a bunch of tete-a-tetes with various premiers. But those are all kind of blurry, confusing messages. Pleasant handshakes and talks about working together, kind of stapled with bits of disagreement. Like, there wasn't a like, oh my God, look at this week in sum. It was about labeling the provinces and taking the fight to them and creating a clear cleavage in terms of competing visions of the country. So that wasn't there. And if the strategy you're talking about was going to be in evidence, that would have been the opportunity to execute it. I just wanted to give you a rest, Corey, because I know you were obviously, based on your voice, out drinking with Conor McGregor until about 3 hours ago.
Yeah, so. I got it. What was your weekend like, Corey?
it was pretty chill, actually. But look, you glossed over on the lead into this, David, what I think the far more consequential change in federal provincial policy and issues was, which was the complete capitulation and swallowing whole of Stephen Guilbeault on the 413 highway. That was acquiescing on a top shelf campaign commitment.
Nothing gives you wood like
Guilbeault. Some people and are highways. In it for the love. Corey is in it for beating up on Guilbeault.
Well, it's a pretty big change, and so that's not a sign of them fighting with the Ford government. That's the sign of them acquiescing to the Ford government on a very key campaign commitment.
So last week, while the late Brian Mulroney lay in state across from Parliament Hill, a new poll came out that would have brought a grin to his famous lantern jaw. Turns out 87% of Liberals now regard his record as positive. Among Bloc Québécois supporters, the number was 90%. Among Conservatives, 85%. You know, to put it mildly, his policies didn't thrill most Canadians back in the day. The country was split on free trade, And the GST, well, you can imagine. A lot of people were also uncomfortable with his drive for privatization. Before Mulroney, governments dominated a slew of industries. They owned Air Canada, several electricity utilities, Petro-Canada, a uranium concern, and a potash company, to name a few. And yes, our sponsor, CN, the biggest railway in Canada. Mulroney believed they would be more efficient and less politicized as private companies. So he aggressively began a sell-off. The left hated privatization, and even the liberal center wasn't keen on it. Privatization shook up the order of things. But in most cases, the performance of the privatized companies soared. CN has gone from trailing the industry in efficiency to leading. It is a reliable and excellent performer in millions of RRSPs. CN was widely mocked as a money sinkhole by experts when it was first sold. But anyone who bought a substantial amount of CN stock 30 years ago has done very well indeed. Okay, look. I know CN was actually sold under Paul Martin, my old boss, a couple of years after Brian Mulroney retired. I was there. But I also know Brian Mulroney laid the groundwork. May the road rise to greet him. To use one of his favorite phrases, Mr. Mulroney was a great Canadian. All right. Last week, there was quite a bizarre scene in the House of Commons. I actually watched it go down on television. I don't normally watch Parliament. For some reason, I watched this. And the MPs had debated all day a motion from the NDP that would quite radically have changed Canadian Middle East foreign policy. Immediate recognition of a Palestinian state, sanctions, no more sale of arms to Israel, sanctions against Israeli settlers, etc. They debated this thing all day. And then on the eve of the vote, Steve McKinnon, our buddy, produces a new motion that is radically different and has a lot of those things taken out of it. That's where Andrew Phillips picks up in the Toronto Star. And he says, the NDP, to start there, comes out of this episode looking foolish, indeed feckless. It went into Monday's debate proclaiming the importance of recognizing a Palestinian state right now, today. By the end of the night, it was signing on to a routine statement about recognizing Palestine eventually as part of a negotiated two-state solution. The traditional Canadian position it had previously dismissed as too wishy-washy for these troubled times. It was like that all along the line. Wherever the NDP had proposed tougher language against Israel, the Liberals managed to roll the wording back. Yet NDP leader Jagmeet Singh was out on social media claiming his party had forced the Liberals to do things they were already doing, through a non-binding resolution no less, while his foreign affairs critic was wringing her hands about not getting what they were after. But the NDP is a bit player in all this. The Liberals have the burden of actually running a G7 government that has pretensions to play a role in major international issues. What they should have done was skip the parliamentary antics and vote against the NDP motion, which went against decades of bipartisan Canadian policy, not to mention current Liberal policy on the Gaza conflict. The fact that they felt the need to engage with the NDP at such lengths hints at bigger divisions in their caucus, and perhaps their cabinet as well, on the Mideast than has become public. So they went down a road that ended nowhere in particular, but managed to create more confusion along the way. Okay, Jordan, I'll let you have first go at this. What the fuck was that all about?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly, I can't remember any other example of an opposition day motion being amended and that amendment being accepted. It was really an unusual circumstance, I think, across the board. And look, I have mixed reviews of the whole thing. I think overall for the NDP, it was a bit of a win. I think they clearly set the agenda for the first part of the last week, and that was part of what they wanted out of it. But tactically, there was a couple things I really didn't like about doing it. And I think so. The first is the fact of doing it. I think that choosing this topic for their opposition day motion, it took them off messages of affordability, of cost of living, and anytime you do that, you're ceding that ground over to the Conservatives. And so I think it was an unfortunate choice in that sense. The second thing I didn't really like about it from a tactical level is that there's an element of risk for sure in this topic. There, it is, unpopular opinion. It is a complex topic. And emotions are running high. And when you need to fill hours and hours of debate on it with speeches, errors can be made, right? And I think we saw the NDP MP Brian Massey step into that, and he did subsequently apologize. But you know, that stuff is not helpful. And I think that when you choose a topic like that, then there's a risk there. There's a reason why in most parties, this is a subject that is usually spoken about by the foreign affairs critic and the leader and not a whole lot of other people. That said, I think once they decided to do it, I think they did it pretty well. And I think that it's clear that they were making a policy point above a political one. And normally I would not score that well, but I'm going to make an exception in this case, because I think that, you know, the proof on that is that they accepted the amendments, obviously, because they could have split the Liberals very badly here. They could have split cabinet. And I think that that's the truth of why the Liberals put forward the amendments and made such great efforts to be able to support the motion. It's because there was going to be a very serious split within cabinet. So they could have refused the amendments and allowed that split to happen. They accepted them. And I think that in this moment where we are seeing a lot of division, I think that was the right call. I think it was better for them to book a win that brought people together in some way than it was to drive division. They did get some real gains around some clarity on the arms export policy that we hadn't seen from Jolie before. Some things on international law, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court recognizing and supporting their work. So those are new. And interestingly, Jolie has been out and she's been very clear. The government does not view this as a non-binding Opposition Day motion. They are going to implement it. So she is out making the case in part for the NDP that this was an impactful motion and that it has changed what their foreign policy is going to be. And so
seems to be a difference of opinion about arms sales.
Right. Well, I mean, and this maybe leads me to I had a couple observations I thought were interesting. And one of them is that for the Liberals, they continue to, on this topic, they're sort of mumbling on the issue. It can be difficult to discern what their policy positions are until they are backed into a corner by one side or the other, which is a problem because they are never given credit for any leadership on the issue. They appear to be reactive, push, drag to one side or the other. And I think that, you know, you reference the arms issue. I think that that's part of it. I mean, perhaps this was already Canada's position, but boy, it sure wasn't clear listening to Jolie on that until last week. So I think that that was an interesting thing to see, that we did continue to see the Liberals really dragged to any new development in their policy and pushed and not able to really take any credit for it. And the second thing that I thought was interesting to observe is that we do seem to see the Conservatives moving away from what was previously an all-party consensus in Canada around the two-state solution. And I wonder a little bit about that, because I think that it does work at cross purposes for them on some of the other initiatives that they've undertaken to try to court Muslim votes. And so I wonder where that's going to land, because to hear Melissa Lantzman speaking last week, they've moved beyond that position. And so I think that that's going to be something to keep an eye on as things develop.
Corey, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think this was smart. I don't think that this drives votes for very many Canadians. And I think it divides every party in weird ways. Like, I look at the Sarah Gemma controversy and how much that hurt Merritt Stiles here in Ontario. this issue can be divisive in all parties, and I don't think there's a clear win. I also think it's of incredibly low relevancy. Like, what Canada thinks and does on the issue of Israel and Palestine is of interest to a handful of Canadians and nobody else around the world, certainly nobody who's driving policy in the region.
Israeli government seems to notice.
I would disagree, Corey. Like, well, Netanyahu and Benny, like, they've reached out about
this. Just to wave our hands and say we don't matter ever about anything.
Okay. All right, I've listened to you guys for a long time. You can listen to me now for a little bit. I think that this is not where voters are. Voters are on a whole host of other issues. You know, we talked about one earlier, housing, affordability. These are the things that the next election is going to be about. And let's be honest, the NDP is in the toilet right now. They're at 18 points. They need to get on to the main game here in terms of what Canadians are concerned about, not wasting opposition days talking about foreign policy issues of very limited relevancy to most Canadians. They're of high relevancy to, you know, some, you know, to some people, clearly, but this is not how you get from 18 points to 25 points. This is not how you get back, you know, into a stronger position as a party. So I think it was a wasted opportunity, a wasted opposition day motion. And at the end of the day, you know, it created some news around it, but to what benefit?
Canada has been a leader in the research, development, and production of nuclear medicine for decades. And with more than 40 million procedures performed around the world each year using medical isotopes, it plays a key role in contributing to the fight against cancer and transforming patient experiences. In addition to producing enough carbon-free nuclear energy to power one in three homes, businesses, and hospitals in Ontario, today's podcast sponsor, Bruce Power, contributes to the world's healthcare system through medical isotope production, and it continues to build on that legacy as the medical community has moved nuclear medicine into a new era. In addition to harvesting the isotope cobalt-60, used to sterilize 40% of the world's single-use medical devices, Bruce Power is the first commercial nuclear reactor in the world to produce lutetium-177, a medical isotope used for targeted therapy of a growing number of cancers, including neuroendocrine tumors and prostate cancer. This is all done using a first-of-a-kind isotope production system, providing a consistent supply of cancer-fighting isotopes to meet growing worldwide demand through continual operations 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bruce Power is proud of the role it continues to play in powering medical innovation and fighting cancer. Together, scientists, researchers, doctors, and the nuclear industry are building a better tomorrow. Corey, can I just push you for a second on something? Because you're right. Most Canadians are not paying attention to this. Most Canadians will not vote on this. Right? But some people will. Some people will. And why is it not in the NDP's political interest to become wholeheartedly pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel? Because wouldn't that give them the best chance of fulfilling the promise of the Jagmeet Singh leadership, which is to basically create a coalition of people of color in suburban Canada?
Well, I agree, but they would have stuck with their original motion, wouldn't they?
Yes. Like,
so, yes. You know, I fail to see the strategy here. So, you know, if they had stuck with their original motion, then I'd say, yeah, okay, maybe you got a point there, David. But they didn't. So what did they do other than, once again, put themselves in, you know, as a minority partner in the Liberal government, parroting largely the pre-existing Liberal position? So, you know, other than, you know, acquiescing to what the longstanding bipartisan position on Israel and Palestine has been, what did they accomplish? Suggesting something and then reversing themselves? I don't know. Like, where's the strategy in that?
Scott, what do you think?
Well, you guys have just stolen my comment, I think, to be honest with you. My fundamental observation on this from a pure political lens was that I don't understand what the NDP did. I do think there was political value, and this is not where I stand personally, but I think there was political value in the NDP moving this motion, making the Liberals squirm, dividing them, and then refusing to accept the amendments from the Liberals. And thereby, and it's true, yes, most Canadians won't vote on this issue in the next election, but there's younger Canadians. There are Canadians who are highly motivated by this issue. Those that are motivated from a Jewish and Israeli perspective seem to have decamped almost entirely to the conservative column. Those on the other side of this issue, I think, are there to be had for the NDP, and they could have had more of them if they'd stuck by this motion and refused to work with the Liberals. And they would have divided the Liberals. The Liberals would have lost more. I think that Andrew Phillips's column is correct with respect to the Liberals. And I think that his observation, I think he answered his own question, which is that the Liberals were divided. They saw that there would be more votes contrary to where the party stood if it had gone the other way than this way. So they lost three members on the vote Anthony Hill's father is contemplating his future. That's all uncomfortable for the liberals, but it would have been, I think, more uncomfortable, and you would have had a more virulent reaction if the original motion had stood and the government had said, we must vote against. So I didn't really understand the logic of the NDP working together on it. And in the biggest of big pictures, setting aside the Israeli question, which I think is a big picture issue, at least from my perspective, it's another example of the NDP and the liberals looking like they're kind of in the same lifeboat together, you know, willing to work on this. Personal relationships, I'm sure, and a fraught, heated day working together. Well, what about this? No, we won't accept that. And Jordan's point is so important. This did affect policy. Like, it's given much more weight politically and certainly from a policy perspective than a normal opposition day motion. Now, Julie is, I would say, altering and certainly clarifying, if you don't agree with alter, the position on arms. And it's a direct consequence of this motion and what was agreed to and what was passed. And so, you know, it's a brutal spot for the government because they are losing on both sides of this. They could have lost even more. But I didn't understand why the NDP decided to play ball. And again, the blurring of the lines between liberals and New Democrats, I think, is really problematic for the Liberal Party further down the road, particularly if they lose the next election. It's going to be a real run on the Liberal bank. What do we need you for?
Jordan, I'll ask you to wrap up on this, but can I ask you, in the process of that, to address, I heard a rumor that some of the Muslim organizations in the country applied pressure to get a resolution passed.
Yes, I've heard the same rumor. And I think, actually, just to go to the question of why did the NDP accept the amendments, I mean, I think let's entertain it at face value. They wanted a win. They wanted to alter policy. And so they, in consultation with the community... But is that a win? Well, yeah, I mean, I think let's.
I'm not being glib. I mean it.
No. Let's indulge for a moment the idea that the
purpose of this. You're talking about a policy win versus a political win.
That's right. I'm talking about.
We're mixing up jargon here.
Yeah, we're mixing up jargon. I'm saying that my point earlier, and it holds, is that they wanted a policy win from this as opposed to a political one, and accepting the amendments was proof of that. They were looking to move the ball forward on the federal government's policy. They did so. And they did that in consultation with the Muslim community. And I think that there was a real push to say, we don't want a symbolic failure. We don't want a vote of the Canadian Parliament against, for example, the recognition of Palestinian statehood. We would rather have something that's a bit stronger, that we have a clear win on, that we can send a message to Israel, where we do know that people are paying attention, that there's been some sort of shift in Canadian foreign policy. And I think on that count, they drove the agenda and they got that win.
Okay, we got to wrap up on this. And yeah. I want to put you on the spot.
Okay,
I want to put you on the spot. And I want to say to you, right, we're a year from a Poilievre government, which is going to have a very different policy on Israel than the current government does. Why would the NDP prefer a one-year modest change in Middle East policy to winning suburban Canada?
Well, I don't know that that's actually the equation before us. And I'm going to say two things about that. One, which is, although we are seeing some discourse out of the Conservatives right now that puts into question their commitment to Canada's traditional policies and that, I also am forced to reflect on the fact that when Harper was prime minister, there was no change to Canada's official policy on the conflict. So I think that there are some strong institutional forces there that will hold Canada close to what our official position has been for a long time. And then for the NDP, I mean, look, you can't be holier than the Pope, right? If they want to have a win with the community and the community saying to them, we want something passed as opposed to a pure motion that fails, well, then, you know, they're going to deliver something that people are asking for, and they were able to do that. This is absolutely not the last time that this topic is going to come up in the House. There's lots of opportunity for the party to continue to differentiate itself from the Liberals on this issue, and I think they're going to continue to take those opportunities. So for me, I think that they really were able to deliver what was sort of asked of them by their stakeholders. They drove the agenda. They clearly forced the government's hand on this. I think they got a win.
Canada's Arctic, a land of both profound transformation and an emerging geopolitical arena. As governments and communities seek solutions for the sustainable maintenance of the North's resources and people, We're in desperate need of a greater understanding of this unique environment. At the forefront of these efforts is an unprecedented interdisciplinary effort at the Université Laval called Sentinel North, bringing together expertise and technologies from a broad network of researchers, institutes, and northern communities. It's pioneering new ways to collaborate on research in the Arctic. Like the leading work of Marcel Babin in remote sensing to use advanced satellite technology to monitor how marine ecosystems respond to climate change in the Arctic. Or Sophie La Rochelle, whose team has developed cutting-edge photonic systems to monitor how the Arctic is evolving. Investing in research can build a more resilient future. That's why U15 Canada is a proud member of the Coalition for Canadian Research. The coalition is urging the federal government to support science and talented Canadian researchers with new funding in this budget. We have to support Canadian ambition, full stop. Visit researchcoalition.ca to learn more. Let's move on to our last topic. With the federal budget close, provincial budgets are starting to drop, as the provinces all know their federal numbers. Ontario has one tomorrow. All Minister Bethlen Falvey has told us so far is that there will be no tax increases and the focus will be on affordability. Corey, what should we be looking for tomorrow?
Well, I think you just, you heard what the, I think the top line differentiation is going to be. I think you're going to hear a lot about carbon tax and about affordability and about drawing a contrast. This is, you know, running right up against the increase in the carbon tax that's going to be coming down. And so I think it's showing a change there. I think you'll hear stuff about Ring of Fire and 413 and other, you know, big priorities, housing that you would expect to hear. Yeah. I think you're going to see a kind of middle approach being taken around spending restraint. You know, I think that as we've talked about many times, people want to see a level of fiscal discipline, but they don't want to see the government going crazy in that direction at this time. They want to make sure that, you know, things are basically stable and steady. I don't think there's going to be
fiscal discipline as long as it doesn't involve tax increases or spending cuts.
Right.
Fiscal discipline, but not sacrifice.
Yes. Right. That's look. I think it's going to be an interesting. To see, how this fight goes with the provinces. But I think you'll see a lot of alignment in all of these provincial governments, taking a very similar approach to what you're going to hear rhetorically and in substance. I don't think you're going to see provincial budgets that are very, very different than what you're going to see in Ontario. I think that's kind of very clearly where the public mood is at. And I think you're going to see provincial governments catering to the overwhelming public opinion research out there around this stuff. I think it's interesting. I wanted to bring up David, because we've talked about this before, the latest Abacus numbers, 41-27-21 in Ontario. That's very close to what it was on election day. And, despite your desire to see the Liberals pull out ahead, there's a 6-point gap there. And running, at least 1 or 2 points behind where Trudeau is in the province. So I think you're seeing a lot of stability on the provincial side. I think the carbon tax fight in provinces like Saskatchewan that are going to be going to the polls are edging back towards Moe's favor in a similar way, and the carbon tax being the issue that's driving it. So, We'll see how it goes, but the failures of the Trudeau government around carbon tax are playing themselves out in all these provincial races as well.
Scott, what do you think the pressure points are for the Ford government in this budget? What do they need to deal with?
I think we've identified the key thing, and that is walking the tricky tightrope that is expenditures. So the government wants to position itself as a careful, capable manager of the fisc, but it's got to be concerned about the political underbelly and the real underbelly that is healthcare. Also education, when we take a look at what's going on with our universities, the province is going to have to come up with some kind of broader structural plan to deal with the post-secondary institution challenge that's happening right now. And that's going to involve like things that are just beyond like, just can we do like a fire drill flash of cash? Like it's going to like, what is the, how many universities should we have in the province? Should there need to be specialization between them? Do we not want that? What's the balance and importance that we place in universities? So there's all those kinds of things, but I really think the soft underbelly is healthcare. And I think in particular, it's healthcare professionals. You know, the wage restraint legislation, which was struck down, is struggling to figure out how to deal with that. I think when we look at nurses, personal support workers, family doctors, I mean, family doctors, I'm talking about GPs. I think all of that stuff is a real pressure points. So the government can't crow too much about well managing the fisc or showing in its budgetary figures or even estimates that it's spending less than it had planned to on things like healthcare and education. That creates political vulnerability for it, because I do think those things are problems. So they got to manage that very, very well. And the government, by and large, does a pretty successful job of keeping the narrative coming out of the government, coming out of Queen's Park, on economic issues and away from education and healthcare. I think that's smart. I think it's got to keep it there, but it's got to get the balance just right, or it will become vulnerable to that conversation taking off. I just think increasingly the inability of people to get a family doctor in the province, and I'm not blaming that entirely on Doug Ford, but it's a big political vulnerability for Doug Ford for the next election. And I don't think you want to do anything to pull the trigger out of that, pull the pin out of that grenade in this budget.
Jordan?
Yeah, I'm in pretty aggressive agreement with Scott, particularly on healthcare. I think that the Ford government has been very disciplined in not putting the light on that topic, but there is a point at which people's lived experience in terms of not having access to a family doctor, wait times, just will overwhelm the fact that it's not the leading political issue right now. And you know, and I think I was thinking a lot about this on Saturday, because I take my kids to swimming lessons on Saturday, and we live around the corner from like a, you know, a drop-in clinic. And every Saturday morning, when I go past there, I see 50 people in line at 9 a.m. on Saturday to see a drop-in clinic. I'm on those like mom Facebook groups, you know, in our community, and every day there's somebody posting that they've lost their family doctor, their doctor has left family practice, and they are struggling to find new care. They've been told it's going to be a 2 to 3 year wait on the central wait list. And people feel the system is absolutely failing them. They feel like it's broken. And at the same time, they're seeing more and more new options. You know, I saw a friend of mine was tweeting a new ad in the TTC today. Pay $450 a year and you can get access to this nurse practitioner clinic. They're seeing privatization creeping into the healthcare system in a really, really visible way. And then, so I think all of these things are really in people's minds. It's something they're thinking about. It's something they're living. And what the Ford government has offered up until now, which is really putting a lot of money into different aspects of private delivery to try to shorten wait times, I don't think it has trickled down into people's experiences. And I think that when you combine it with the lasting impacts of Bill 124 and that wage suppression has just been, it's just been really deadly. You're driving healthcare workers out of the public sector. It's costing the government more over time, and people don't feel like it's fixing the problems when there's over 2 million Ontario folks who don't have family doctors, you know, there's a real problem here. So I think that if there isn't any opening in this budget, if there's anything that can be spun out to suggest that there's cut or a reduction in funding that is going to hamper people's access and not address these problems head on, I think it's a massive vulnerability. And I know that Mart Stiles and the NDP are all over this. They released their big healthcare plan last week in the lead up to the budget. So that's like, they're squarely going at that, which I think it's smart for them to work on a topic that is plays to their traditional strengths. But I think the Ford government, they've played it pretty smart up until now, but I think it's a growing vulnerability for them.
Last week, you heard from Wealthsimple about the trust they've earned from more than 3 million Canadians that use them to save, spend, invest, or file their taxes. And trust is what Wealth Simple is all about. Take their investing platform. Wealth Simple's advisors are fiduciaries, which means they give you advice that's in your best interest, not theirs. It's their job to understand where you are today, where you want to be tomorrow, and to help get you there with clear and actionable recommendations. Wealth Simple's advisors are ready to answer your questions about money without giving you a hard sell. If you want your portfolio managed for you, Wealth Simple's management fees are 0.5% or less, compared to an average of 2% for Canadian mutual funds. As a 10-year-old company, Wealth Simple doesn't have the luxury of lifelong customers. They have to earn every dollar by offering the best possible value and the highest possible quality of service. And really, that's finance as it should be. Do you agree with that, Corey, that healthcare is a pressure point, especially personnel? And I don't even know what you do about it. Like, I mean, well, it seems to me that the family practitioner model is broken in terms of compensation and broken in terms of work-life balance. And we just can't get people to do those fucking jobs.
Yeah, I think it's a pressure for every provincial government. But it's also eating up half of the budget, as you know, in every province. So I don't think you're going to see any cuts to healthcare, quite the opposite. But the challenge is there's not enough money in the system overall. I agree with both Scott and Jordan on HHR sort of issues, health human resources. But I think that there's some interesting things happening in that area, particularly in Ontario, where your nursing education is now free. In combination with you signing a 5-year contract to agree to stay in the public system and go where there's a vacancy. Same for PSWs. That is a fundamental change in how this stuff is being managed in the past. And I don't think it gets enough attention and enough focus. And I do think it's delivering results and will increasingly over time. In terms of wages, yes, but I think those issues have largely been settled in that contracts have been signed with nurses, that will go past the next election. So, compensation for back wages as a result of the loss of Bill 124. So, I don't see big fights on the horizon there because, there isn't going to be a strike. There's union issues have been settled. I think where the public is more, and I think this is the trickier balancing act, is that people are feeling a lot of anxiety around the economy, a lot more than the numbers would suggest in terms of we have very small growth in the economy, but if you ask most people, they think we're in a recession, and why is that? It's because they are suffering. Personally, right now, this is why affordability is so high. They're paying more for everything. They have concerns about their mortgage or their rent. They have concerns about the grocery bill, and their own personal financial situation is a lot more distressed than macroeconomic numbers would indicate. So, I think if there's anything that there's a big vulnerability for every government on, it's really empathizing with where people are at on the economic risks side of the equation. So framing that correctly, I think, is really where is the name of the game right now for everyone.
All right. I think it's time for Mr. Pinsent. Gordon Pinsent, can you assemble everybody for the Hey Yous?
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
All right. Scott, go.
Well, actually, I'm going to pick up on what Corey was just saying, but go in a completely different direction. Inflation came in this past week at 2.8%. It was thought to be going to be at 3.1%. That brings it within the 1-3 band for the second month in a row. It's actually running at about 2.3% on a rolling 3-month average. GDP was, expected to go into the negative. It actually ran at 1% in the last report. We'll get another GDP update for Canada and the US this coming week. What am I saying here? What I'm saying is that people do feel anxious, and they're right to feel anxious, and it's been a rough economic time. But that soft landing, quote unquote, that economists are talking about, which they didn't believe was going to be pulled off in the aftermath of the wrenching, unprecedented you know, expenditures and turmoil and disruption in the economy created by the pandemic and the responses of central banks, Tiff Macklem gets the shit kicked out of him all the time. And I know that people feel anxious, and I know that that's going to affect the next election, and it's certainly affecting our politics right now. But I know it would also be worse if we weren't on the verge of pulling off a soft landing. And from a policy perspective, I just think it's worth noting, it's unfucking real that these guys are landing this plane. We're not going to feel like we're on ground and that we've been rescued and that we've been saved for 3, 4, 5 years down the road. But I think 2 decades down the road, we're going to look back and go, it's almost nothing short of a miracle that we could go through that, not end up in a recession, not have a larger correction. And, you know, within a year, year and a half, managed to get CPI kind of back under control. And the last remaining huge contributor is what they call shelter inflation, which Corey talks about all the time. And, you know, that's a consequence of trying to tame the tiger. So as we start to see rate cuts, that's going to start to ease. And not a lot will probably be in time to save Justin Trudeau. But it's from a public policy perspective, like, holy fuck. It's been a remarkable thing. So Tiff Macklem gets no love. I'm going to give a little bit to him.
Well, I thought Scott was going to join Corey and I on the Change the Bank of Canada mandate island, but
it's not quite. It's so au courant to be talking about, don't worry about your popularity right now. Understand the judgment of history will be kind to you. Yes. So that's,
Scott, that's right. I'm out of time.
A big narrative thread through Canadian politics right now. Jordan, you got to hate you.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I was just thinking that, yeah, Scott, I felt like Scott was also channeling the Biden campaign a little bit there. not wrong, but a tough sell.
Not wrong, so, just old and losing.
Maybe not, though. Numbers were better last week. Okay, so my Hey You this week is going out to Premier Eby. I thought there was a cute little episode last week. So Pierre Poilievre had sent out letters to all of the premiers, exhorting them to speak up in opposition to the carbon tax. And I thought it notable that Eby was really the only premier who didn't just sort of immediately roll over and accept the frame. And that he came out and said, quote, "I don't live in the Pierre Poilievre campaign office and baloney factory," which I thought was funny and clippable. But more to the point, that he actually came back and punched back harder on Poilievre, on affordability, on climate action, much harder, much more effectively than we've seen from the federal government really at any point in the last year. And then he's doing so with his opponents trailing 20 points behind. And I think there's some lessons there for the federal liberals in terms of how to knit together that affordability and climate argument, and also just not in accepting the frame and really sticking closer to some terrain that is more useful to you than to your political opponent. So I think it's not a mistake that Poilievre has been attacking Eby. I say a salute and a hey you to Eby for being worthy of that attack.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that we're looking at
the polling numbers on the,
But Rustad's numbers are going up. Falcon's numbers are going down. Eby's numbers are going down. As that race polarizes more around carbon tax, I think it's not necessarily great for Eby, and it would certainly look like it's great for Rustad. So I don't know.
We'll see.
Well, it's certainly not great for BC United.
Yeah.
That's
who appear
clear
to be disappearing under the waves.
I mean, right, from in great part through their own doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Corey, you got to hate you.
I got to hate you. I just want to throw a shout out to Peter Bethlenfavi, who's a fan of the podcast and of the Hurly Burly as well, to wish him luck in the budget tomorrow. I'm sure he'll do well, and hope he comes and joins you, David, and on the Hurly Burly to talk about it more at some point.
He's scheduled, Corey. He's coming next week. It's awesome.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent news.
My hey you goes out to Steve McKinnon and all the other liberals that were involved in pulling together the amendment. to the Mideast motion. I think it's certainly was in the best interest of the Liberal Party not to have that split exposed. And I actually think it was in the interest of the country to yank the NDP back toward the consensus on support for Israel and away from the more extreme position that they were moving toward. I think that's in Canada's interest and in Israel's interest. And I support all of those. I support all of those things. And I know that there was, it may not have been perfect parliamentary procedure, but I can imagine all the wheels that were in motion behind the scenes to get to that point. And it was ultimately impressive and well done. So, hey, you to you. All right, folks, that's our show for today. I want to thank Jordan, Scott, and Corey for being here. Corey, especially for fighting through what sounds like a bad throat situation. I want to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsors, CN, Bruce Power, U15 Canada, and Wealth Simple. And of course, I want to thank all of you Hurley Burleyites who watched or listened to the show this week. Thank you so much for doing that, and we'll see you next week with more of The Curse of Politics. Till then, take care of yourselves.